Blog Talk Radio. From the Eastern Files. The program is dedicated to memories and stories of former Eastern people and news from the New Eastern, as we feel you might want to hear the latest news. These broadcasts will usually be only about 1/2 hour in duration and broadcast in the 3 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time slot. We may even throw in a music selection or two. The program will not be on a talk radio format basis, in that we will not take calls. It will be reserved only for Eastern history and news. We will continue to broadcast our normal talk radio call-in live show on Mondays at 7 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time. Now, we hope you'll like this new addition to the Eastern radio show. Now let's take a listen to an Eastern commercial of the past.
Yep, scramble. Let's not keep them waiting.
At the Eastern Air Shuttle, we have a crew on standby whose sole mission is to fly you to Boston or Washington whenever one of our regular shuttle planes is full. And for that reason, we at the Eastern Air Shuttle Service can guarantee you something no other airline can. A seat. The Eastern Air Shuttle, a guaranteed seat without a reservation.
Well, now, let's get right into another story from the Eastern Files. This story is by James Jimmy Goodwin, and it was found in the 1989 issue of Repartee magazine. It's titled, Flying the Mail. Edward G. Beringer was a pioneer. He started at the bottom with Pitcairn Aviation about the time the first mail wing was test flown, and shortly thereafter, he was taught to fly by Pitcairn pilots. He became a flight instructor, an airmail pilot, and when his flying career was cut short in a bizarre accident while extending himself beyond the call of duty in the finest tradition of the airmail service, he accepted the inevitable and carved out an important role for himself in the building of a great airline, Eastern. Aviation people love to recount tales of the early days. Stories of humor and daring and even tragedy are part of their lore. Most center around the pilot. Of the 85 employees on the payroll when Harold Pitcairn's airline started operating on May 1, 1928, over 40% were pilots. Roles between pilots and field managers often changed. Most managers were pilots. Fred Schimali was field manager in Miami during the week, but as a reserve pilot, he flew the Mail. Roles between pilots and field managers often changed. Most managers were pilots. Fritz between Miami, Daytona Beach on weekends. He would fly. He later became superintendent of Eastern's maintenance and repair depot in Atlanta, but returned to flying and retired as a Delta captain. Elmer Cross, an early airmail pilot who became the first superintendent of the depot in Atlanta, changed places with Fritz and moved to Miami. Names like Glenn J. McDonnell and George Cushing are shown on early records as field managers. Changes came fast in those days, but when stories are told of the romance of flying, Ed Behringer is rarely mentioned. Few lists of pioneer pilots include his name. This omission results from a combination of modesty on his part and the fast pace of events as the young organization struggled for existence. Behringer built a reputation as a rock-solid station manager, and that is the way most remember him. The year 1927 ushered in an era of great activity. Newspapers carried daily stories of plans for transoceanic flights, but Lindbergh's solo flight to Paris really awakened the world to the possibilities of aviation. Harold Pitcairn, a World War I flight instructor, owner of the largest fixed base operation east of the Mississippi, and builder of airplanes, had ambitions to have his own airline. Shortly after, he was awarded a contract to carry mail between New York and Atlanta. He and his associates started designing a plane to do the job, and 6 months later, test flew the PA-5, powered by a 220-horsepower Wright engine. It was the first in a series of mail wings, perhaps the best in the airmail business. An automobile mechanic, Ed Behringer, from Percasse, Pennsylvania, like many other young men of that day, had dreams of becoming a pilot. He applied for a job with Pitcairn Aviation at Athens, Pennsylvania, but there was no opening for a mechanic, so he started on July 18, 1927, with the unromantic title of ground man at $15 a week. But by November, Ed was in Atlanta working as a mechanic for Ben Faulkner, who headed up Pitcairn's fixed base operation. Johnny Keitel and Sterling Smith were the pilots. Smith was Pitcairn's first employee, serving as ground man for Harold Pitcairn's Farman sport plane in 1923, before the company was formed. Behringer continued to build up his flying time, and by the summer of 1928, Ben Faulkner transferred him to Greensboro as a pilot. Now flying for field manager H.W. Rufus, he was kept busy with student instruction, passenger hops, and an occasional cross-country trip. Another young pilot, Pitcairn pilot at Greensboro, was Earl Miles. And he found Behringer to be quiet, serious, and well-liked. He was a good pilot, said Miles, and worked hard to build up his flying time. In August of 1929, after 11 months in Greensboro, he was promoted again and transferred to Jacksonville as a reserve airmail pilot on the new AM-25 route between Atlanta and Miami. The young pilot was now reporting to A.P. Kerr, superintendent of the AM-25 division. I've flown a lot of crates and heard the wind whip by and felt the gear lift off as I fought to gain my prize, was one little quote remembered in this story. On Saturday, November 16th, Ed Behringer, now 22 years old, a seasoned airmail pilot in the framework of operations in 1929, walked out to his plane. It was a beautiful machine, shining black fuselage and golden wings. The large Pitcairn winged arrow emblazoned on its side, and the words Pitcairn Mail Wing nearly neatly lettered on its golden rudder. In front was a large radial engine, giving the impression of ample power. The young pilot climbed in, rolled his shoulders to get more comfortable in the parachute harness, and waggled the controls. As the mechanic called out, "Contact!" he flipped the switch. A moment later, there was the roar of the engine, the wind of the slipstream, and the satisfying feeling of activity as he prepared for his trip to Atlanta. Taxiing out, the reassuring growl of the powerful whirlwind engine failed to drown the discordant rumble of the tail skid dragging along at the runway. It was a medley etched in the memory of every old-time pilot. Saturday was a beautiful autumn day in Jacksonville, with a few white clouds dotting the bright blue sky. But Beringer had studied the reports along the route and knew they were not good. The weather was expected to hold at Macon, but a large disturbance extending from the Great Lakes to the Gulf made Atlanta less certain. The prospect of bad weather did little to dim the sheer joy of flying the mail. In fact, he welcomed the challenge. As his experience increased, he had found a growing satisfaction in coping with the many problems of making schedule. Going around and through bad weather was something his flying in Greensboro had not included. It only added to his confidence and made him feel more secure in the fact that he was now a part of that small cadre of airmail pilots whose membership he had worked so hard to join. Climbing out of the Jacksonville airport, he turned northwest to pick up Highway 23, which paralleled the airway. Leveling off, he settled down to easy flying and was soon over the intermediate field of Folkestone. As he flew over the quiet South Georgia countryside, Beringer's thoughts may have taken him back over his short but happy period on the line. He was lucky to have adjusted so easily. He knew that. Some had not been so fortunate. When Pitcairn Aviation started operating just 18 months earlier, a number of problems marred the record. Vern Treat's mail wing hit a pothole in landing at Philadelphia one night and turned on his back. A week later, bucking headwinds, Treat ran out of gas and made a dead stick landing at night near Richmond. He arranged to have the mail trucked to Bird Field. A few weeks later, Johnny Keitel left Atlanta, heading north in threatening weather. He soon became lost and hit fog-shrouded Stone Mountain. But he lived to tell about it. Then, 3 weeks after the start of service, sledgehammer blows rocked the young company. Edward J. Morrissey took off at night from Bird Field, headed north. As he quickly disappeared into the cloud bank, field personnel heard his engine change from a full throttle climb to a screaming dive. This was followed by a reddish glow in the fog. He had lost his life on his very first trip carrying the mail. Four nights later, James R. Reed, Morrissey's replacement, climbed out of Bird Field in good weather on the same schedule. For some unknown reason, he was attempting an emergency landing when he went over an embankment and lost his life. They were brave pilots who laid down their lives on the altar of the airmail service. Now, passing over McRae, Beringer's thoughts turned to the present as he noted an ominous darkening of the horizon. The weather system was moving faster than expected. Skies were thickening, and soon wisps of fog were rushing between the gold wing panels as he dropped lower to stay under the stuff. The rotating beacon with its green flashing code designating the Cochrane emergency field was reassuring as he tried to push through to Macon. The pilot soon found himself being wedged lower, and at times scud obscured the wings. Turning back was the only choice. But then he found a solid bank of clouds in every direction. Pinched off, looking for a place, any place to land, he kept dropping down. Suddenly, there appeared a hole. Kicking the rudder and putting the left wing down to kill speed, he slipped the male wing down for a landing in a welcome pasture. He knew he was lucky. Sterling Smith, now field manager at Macon, was in the process of calling emergency fields and towns along the route to find some trace of the missing plane. When his friend arrived at Herbert Smart Airport in a rented car, mail piled high in the back seat. They quickly decided to take the mail to Atlanta, where much of it would continue on Pitcairn's northbound route. It was not a good night for driving. The old Dixie Highway, as Route 41 was patriotically known, went through the heart of most of the towns along its route. Fog, mist, and Saturday night traffic made progress slow, particularly near the more populated areas. It was late in the evening when Beringer pulled into Candler Field and delivered the mail to Ben Faulkner's boys. His trip was over. The two pilots started back without delay. Sterling Smith was now driving. Patches of fog were noticeably in low places, and conditions were growing worse. They had been traveling a long time when they passed through Barnesville. Bright lights from an approaching car and their own lights in the fog made it difficult to see the road. Suddenly, Smith braked hard and swerved sharply to the left, but it was too late. Beringer, with nothing to grasp, was thrown forward and against the right window. There was a heavy thud outside the door and the sound of shattering glass as the car came to a stop. Smith opened his door. "We hit something," Beringer, somewhat shaken up, carefully freed himself from pieces of the broken plate glass. After a few moments, they found a still form lying in the drainage ditch, which ran beside the road. With help from a motorist who had stopped, they pulled 15-year-old Jacob Speller up. He was soaked, bleeding from a scalp wound, and groggy. Just then, they noticed Beringer was holding a handkerchief to his face. "You hurt, Ed?" "Something in my eye," Sterling Smith stiffened at the implication of those words. He knew nothing could be done on that fog-bound road. "We need a doctor. Let's go back to Barnesville." The doctor lost no time in calling for an ambulance. "You both should be in the hospital." A.P. Kerr left Jacksonville the next day for Macon. With him was G.E. Slim Thomas, who would fly the mail wing out of the pasture. When they arrived at the Middle Georgia Sanatorium, they found the Spiller boy recovering, not seriously hurt, but Beringer had received heartbreaking news from the doctors. A patch of fog, the figure dim, a shard of glass. His prize was lost. Undaunted by the cruel twist of fate, which cost him so dearly, Ed was soon working for A.P. Kerr in Jacksonville. After only 1 year of operation, Pitcairn Aviation was making money. The challenge was over for Harold Pitcairn, whose interest had turned to the development of rotary wing aircraft. He sold the airline to powerful Curtis Keyes Company on June 12, 1929, with the stipulation that his employees would be retained for 2 years. Clement Keyes later sold the airline again, this time to North American Aviation. In early 1930, the name was changed to Eastern Air Transport, and Eastern's first organizational chart was distributed. Edward G. Barringer was shown as assistant to A.P. Kerr, line superintendent in charge of the AM 25 division in Jacksonville. S.L. Sid Shannon was assistant to L.S. Harding in charge of AM 19 division in Richmond. The new president of the airlines was Thomas B. Doe. Barringer soon became field manager in Jacksonville. During the years that followed, he served as station manager, as they were later called, in Chicago, and again in Jacksonville, and later at LaGuardia, when Northeast Airlines sought him out. He was ready for executive responsibilities, and when Northeast became a part of Delta Airlines, he remained in Boston as regional manager of properties until his retirement. That's the end of the story. A few footnotes related to this story found that although the research on this story covers several years of effort, the author, Jimmy Goodwin, acknowledges use of literary license to fill in unverifiable gaps in the story. REPA, the Retired Eastern Pilots Association, confers upon each male wing pilot the title captain when his name is added to the memorial plaque on the walls of the Hartley Building in Miami. From a Christmas message, Max Freeman, then president of Carolina's Wings, OX5 Aviation Pioneers, and that was one of the poems that was cited. The same weather system found another victim. A young pilot named Johnny Gill was flying five members of the Georgia Tech team from Athens to Atlanta after a football game when weather closed in on him. He cracked up when making a forced landing near Stockbridge, Georgia. Gill went through a window a foot square, and the other passengers tumbled out the best they could. Two were injured. Johnny Gill became an Eastern pilot the following year and remained with the company until his retirement. Now, I have just a few minutes left, and I found an interesting letter from one of the captains to his chief pilot, and I'd like to read it. It's a short letter, but I think you'll get the hang of what the letter was all about as we read through a letter that was written by Captain G.H. Pat Prince in Atlanta, Georgia. And it was directed to Captain Van Rolen, manager of operations, Eastern Airlines in Atlanta. And his letter went, "Dear Captain Rolen, on my days off, I contracted to repair a building, which was severely damaged by a storm. When I got to the building, I found that the storm had knocked some bricks off the top, so I rigged up a beam with a pulley at the top of the building and hoisted up a couple of barrels of brick. When I repaired the building, there were a lot of bricks left over, so I hoisted the barrel back up again and secured the line at the bottom and then went up and filled the barrel with the extra bricks. Then I went down to the bottom and cast off the line. Unfortunately, the barrel of bricks was heavier than I was, and before I knew what was happening, the barrel started down, jerking me off the ground. I decided to hang on, and halfway up, I met the barrel coming down and received a severe blow on the shoulder. I then continued up to the top, banging my head against the beam and getting my fingers jammed in the pulley. When the barrel hit the ground, it burst its bottom, allowing all the bricks to spill out. I was now heavier than the bricks, and so started down again at a high rate of speed. Halfway down, I met the barrel coming up and received severe injuries on my shins. When I hit the ground, I landed on the bricks, getting severe painful cuts from the sharp edges. At this point, I must have lost my presence of mind because I let go of the line and the barrel then came down, giving me another blow on the head and putting me in the hospital. I respectfully request sick leave. Signed, Pat. Well, that's our show as far as from the Eastern Files, Episode 4. We hope you've enjoyed it, and we enjoy doing these because, after all, we're listening to the history of a great airline and the history is told by Eastern folks. So we are glad that we are able to bring this to you. We hope you enjoyed these great Eastern stories, and as I said, they're selected from the Eastern Files. If you'd like to contribute a story of your own from your Eastern days and in your own voice, or to be read on the broadcast, please give us an email, and we will show you how simple it is to tell your story from the Eastern Files. Send your story to host@ealradioshow.com. Again, send it to simply the word host@ealradioshow.com. We want you to be a part of the radio show. So let's hear from you. Until next week and another broadcast from the Eastern Files, we say so long, Eastern family. We love you, Eastern, as we sign off with a very popular singer singing one of my favorite songs.
All my bags are packed, I'm ready to go. I'm standing here outside your door. I hate to wake you up to say goodbye, but the dawn is breaking, it's early morn. The taxi's waiting, he's blown his horn. Already I'm so lonesome I could die. So kiss me and smile for me, tell me that you wait for me. Hold me like you never let me go. 'Cause I'm leaving on a jet plane, don't know when I'll be back again. Oh babe, I hate to go. There's so many times I've let you down, so many times I've played around. I tell you now, they don't mean a thing. Every place I go, I'll think of you. Every song I sing, I'll sing for you. When I come back, I'll bring your wedding ring. So kiss me and smile for me, tell me that you'll wait for me. Hold me like you'll never let me go. 'Cause I'm leaving on a jet plane, don't know when I'll be back again. Oh babe, I hate to go. The time has come to leave you. One more time, let me kiss you. Then close your eyes and I'll be on my way. Dream about the days to come when I won't have to leave alone. About the times I won't have to stay. Kiss and smile for me, tell me that you'll wait for me. hold me like you'll never let me go. 'Cause I believe in on a jet plane, don't know when I'll be back again. Oh babe, I hate to go. I'm leaving on a jet plane, don't know when I'll be back again. Oh babe, I hate to go. Oh,